Tonight with Dave Hodgson on Talk Radio Europe.
Yeah, welcome back to the show, and I'm delighted to introduce Tony Gosling from Bilderberg.org. Hi, Tony.
Hello.
Hi, how are you?
Very fine, absolutely
good.
Fine.
Now, Tony, go on.
As usual, over some of the current events that have been going on in the news over the last few days, particularly over Libya, which is quite clearly... I mean, I think if you're sitting on the moon and watching this, maybe you can see a better perspective than watching the BBC, because it seems to have been simply parroting, really, the British foreign policy objectives and not seeing... I mean, if you think of the coverage over the last 6 months or so, there's been constant coverage of the so-called rebel side and very, very little from Gaddafi supporters. I mean, for example, I covered this right... back in February, March, when it first started, with someone who lives in Bristol, where we do our programme every Friday on the radio, and his family were basically Gaddafi supporters. And we did an initial interview with him, and he was very, very clear straight away. He said, look, I can't do any more interviews because of the fact that there's so many threats against my family over in Libya, and we can't speak any more about it, basically, until this latest... sort of end of this with this horrific death on television of Gaddafi.
I was going to ask you what you make of that. It was on TV. It's something that maybe 15-20 years ago we wouldn't have seen, and yet now we're seeing this happening. We're seeing somebody losing their life before our eyes.
Well, there's all sorts of figures of the number of people that have died in this whole campaign, including, of course, those that have died due to our taxpayers' money and then the bombs being dropped by NATO aircraft. Something like anything between 2,000 and 20,000 dead. We haven't seen any of those during this conflict. What we have, though, seen is Gaddafi at the very end on our television screens. They haven't really shown us anything in the way of sort of gruesome pictures of Gaddafi. In any way, they're breaking their own broadcasting guidelines by broadcasting this in the afternoon, on the evening, early evening news, where children can watch it. And I would imagine there's quite a few horrified children around Britain grasping the hand of their parents and saying, good God, what is this?
I was just going to say, Tony, that's in Spain. They're a lot more open about what they show on the news, and I know in different countries as well, and England's a bit more sensitive when it comes to that. But you're saying is it probably more controversial in England than it would be actually in Spain? Does that make sense?
Well, I think that basically these sorts of broadcasting rules seem to be implemented on some occasions when it's politically suitable and others when it's not. And obviously, the death of Gaddafi is politically significant. But what is also important is that if we're going to be seeing these kind of gruesome pictures on our television, that we're also seeing the gruesome pictures of the ordinary people, the thousands of ordinary people that have been dying as part of this campaign. Otherwise, we're not really getting a true perspective, and one could really charge the BBC with being propagandists rather than news reporters. I mean, the other aspect to all of this is we heard at the end of last week, not only from David Cameron, who I would expect to lie about this sort of thing, but also from people like Tim Huell at the BBC, that the Libyans were responsible for, and this lie was repeated, for the Lockerbie bombings and also for the death of PC Yvonne Fletcher outside the Libyan embassy in the 1980s. Now, look, there's a real serious problems with this, because investigations by TV documentaries over the last 20 years or so have proved really beyond any shadow of a doubt that you cannot simply say that. There are extremely strong doubts over whether or not Yvonne Fletcher was actually shot from the Libyan embassy. It looks certainly, according to a ballistics expert, a serving officer in the British Army at the time, when the documentary was put out on Channel 4 Dispatches called Death in St. James, that the trajectory of the bullet through the body could not possibly have come from the Libyan embassy, because it sort of entered her body, her neck, and then came out through the small of her back, around near her kidneys, and it was shot from above. Now, it also just so happens that the British security services were renting the top floor of an apartment right above where Yvonne Fletcher was standing. So
have we got proof of that? There's proof of that.
there is proof of that in the documentary. Now, it's almost as if these documentaries were never broadcast, and I think David Cameron is hoping that people don't go on the internet and re-watch them, because they are extremely powerful. We've got very senior sources saying that this myth of Yvonne Fletcher being killed from the Libyan embassy, it has to be properly questioned. And also with the Lockerbie bombings, the documentary there was called The Maltese Double Cross. That was broadcast on Channel 4, albeit with some cuts, and it proves that it is very likely that the Libyans weren't involved in that either, that that was the Iranians, possibly, and the Syrians, certainly in conjunction with people doing drug running from the United States under the cover of the Central Intelligence Agency. So there are all sorts of questions about both of those events, and it was really quite horrifying, not only to see Cameron outside Downing Street, the British Prime Minister, repeating these untruths, but also to see the BBC doing so as well. And you do rather think that the whole thing is there to really just try and galvanise the British public behind the whole Libya operation. Now,
Tony, can I just ask?
Gaddafi was no saint, by any means, but there are some big prizes in the takeover, one of which is the oil, obviously, but the other one, maybe not so obvious, is the Libyan money. I mean, he'd been able to run his economy to provide fantastic social services for his people, and he certainly wasn't in any debt. I would imagine in the future that we'll see Libya fall into the same kind of situation as many of the other Arab countries that maybe aren't so oil-rich, and that is that they are beholden to the international financial system.
Yeah. Can I just ask a question? Because would you consider yourself to be a conspiracy theorist, or is that taken as a an insult by you?
Well, I just really, I suppose I sort of laugh at the term, really, because what used to be called investigative journalism is now often called conspiracy theory.
Yeah.
These documentaries, in their time, were considered, the one or two I was talking about, Death in St. James, and which was on Channel 4 Dispatches, and were two-parter, actually, by Fulcrum Productions, and the other one, The Maltese Double Cross, which also went out on Channel 4, the director was Alan Frankovic, at their time were considered to be cutting-edge investigative journalism.
Yeah.
Nowadays, this kind of thing is referred to as conspiracy theory, and I've spoken to several senior people, including Brian Barr from the BBC, who was an investigative journalist. He was producing something called a series called Secret Society in the 1980s, and he has told me categorically and publicly that documentaries like his now could never be made. They would never be commissioned.
Right.
So what's happened is this kind of cutting edge investigative journalism really just simply is not happening anymore.
Why is it? I mean, I'm going to be very controversial now. There seems to be sometimes a bias on the BBC, and what is that coming from the top of the BBC? Is that coming from government? I'm going to get very controversial and say certain stories that we see about Israel and Palestine can sometimes be very biased in either direction. Now, is that something that's coming from the top of the BBC, or is that something that's government-led?
Well, I don't think the BBC are the only broadcaster to be biased. What happens, of course, in these kind of horrifically bad economic times is that we get less and less quality programming and more nonsense by the broadcasters. And what happens is, and the BBC is kind of swept along with this as a non-commercial, with all the other commercial channels, because they kind of set the pace to grab audiences, is you get people buying up channels and buying up newspapers and buying up the media simply for its political influence. There's a really good case in point is the Daily Telegraph. This has been sort of traded around over the last 20 years, various elite, super rich people, in order to peddle political influence. I mean, and also do things like organise the raid on the House of Commons, where a hard drive was stolen with a whole load of information about MPs' expenses. This is the kind of political sting that these big organisations are now able to run, and they run rather like private intelligence services. For instance, Rupert Murdoch in New York is said to have, and I don't know if he's closed it down yet, as part of his News Corp operation, a secret bunker in the bottom of their headquarters where basically a private intelligence gathering operation is going on, with data being sniffed around on the internet, and also basically spies working for Murdoch. Now, the problem with that is not all the information goes into the Murdoch papers. Some of it is used to, and I use this word very carefully, almost like blackmail people. So to say, look, we have this information on you. We think it's a good idea if you do this. Otherwise, yeah. It might appear tomorrow on the front page of the newspaper.
Okay.
So the press is a very, very powerful tool. Mm. Media is a very powerful tool. And I think what's happening in rough economic times is some very ruthless people are getting hold of it.
Now, what I'm going to ask you is that, I mean, obviously, if I got a strong viewpoint in one area, then and I watch the BBC, however they report it, I'm going to think that they are biased, even sometimes when they're not being biased. So that must also, I mean, you come from your own world viewpoint, which will also colour what you receive from the television, whatever channel it is. So I'm not having to dig at the BBC there. But what I'm saying is, when it comes to these type of things, I like to make up my own opinion on each one, given the evidence. And I'm a bit worried that some conspiracy theorists, I'm saying that in quotes, don't believe anything anymore. Everything's a conspiracy theory. Would you feel that some people go too far in that direction, or is there a balance to be had?
Of course they do. You're absolutely right. Of course they do. And I think one of the effects of all of this is it really turns people off from the news. People don't really trust the news anymore. They don't trust what they see on TV. And also, this is just also fueling a kind of general distrust in authority. When you hear stories like, you know, the Norway massacre back in August with Anders Breivik, it's now been shown that he was one of the original authors of the founding documents of the English Defence League. Mm. And this is this rather racist organisation that's very closely linked to some of the pro-Israeli state organisations that goes around causing all sorts of mayhem. As a racist organisation, you would have thought that Breivik would have been watched. Well, it turns out that he got hold of a whole load of fertilizer, which is known to be used in explosives, and yet the authorities did nothing about it. So it's really nothing strange, I think, to think that people around Europe find that they simply don't trust the authorities anymore. You know, that they feel that there is a mistrust there, that the people who are supposed to be looking after them, it's almost like they're being looked after not by shepherds but by wolves.
Is there a TV channel out there that's actually going against the grain and reporting and still doing this type of reporting for you?
One channel that is upsetting Hillary Clinton, which has got to be a good thing, which is Russia Today, and they seem to be really, I suppose, showing us in a lot of ways how there is a very little, or there's quite a lot of misreporting, and there are whole points of view which simply aren't being reported in much of the Western media nowadays. And they seem to, you know, pick up on quite a lot of stories. And it's one of the things that I found very interesting here in Britain is that people from the left and the right are impressed with what the Russians are doing with their English language channel.
Yeah.
They've invited me on a few times, and I'm not just saying that because they have. One of the things that they also, I mean, I come back home in the evenings. My wife is watching it. You know, if this is the sort of thing which actually quite a lot of it, reasonably intelligent people around Europe are now tuning in away from these more propagandistic, jingoistic, you know, pro-UK foreign policy channels. I mean, this is weirdly, this is the sort of thing we used to point the finger over at the old Soviet Union and say, oh, we know nobody really believes Pravda because you're just telling the people what you want them to think.
Yeah.
Well, that's exactly what's happening now, I think, in a lot of the British media, and particularly with regard to this whole Libya story. There's been not a lot of criticism, really, of the whole, and there's been an assumption right from the very start that the old regime that Gaddafi overturned in the 1960s was somehow a wonderful regime, and that Gaddafi has been a dictator. Well, that's wrong on both counts, I'm afraid. The original prince that Gaddafi got rid of was imposed on Libya by the British, and also it wasn't actually a dictatorship. There were quite a lot of policies that Gaddafi couldn't get implemented because he had an elected assembly, small even though, that he simply couldn't get a lot of policies through there. So it wasn't the classic kind of dictatorship, a kind of military dictatorship
that we all know. Yeah.
I mean, it wasn't a fantastic place either, and there were a lot of freedoms that simply didn't exist in Libya. A friend of mine that visited there, she was arrested several times, eventually released, but then, you know, they thought that she was a bit suspicious. And so, in a way, you can see why Gaddafi was right to be suspicious about the West. Now, what's happened to him and the way that the regime has been toppled with a lot of support, it's not just ordinary Libyans that have overturned it, lots of support, quite clearly, from special forces from right across Europe, you know, from and a lot of support from the United States. All the tankers, pretty much, which were refueling the aircraft as they flew over to bomb Libya, were American. Mm. The Americans have tried to keep their fingers clean on this one and get the British and the French to do their dirty work and the bombing.
Yeah. Now, so that's very much in the news at the moment. Now, also in the news, Hillsborough. So you've got something on there as well, haven't you, on a so-called cover-up?
Well, that's right. I mean, the Hillsborough families have been begging, really, for the truth to come out ever since 1989, when the biggest stadium disaster in Britain ever happened. Mm. And it's always been quite, certainly from about a year after the attack, from the disaster, that the police were implicated. But on our programme, in Bristol, I interviewed a former senior intelligence analyst at South Yorkshire Police. The Hillsborough was the football stadium of Sheffield Wednesday, and there was an FA Cup tie going on there when all this happened. And so South Yorkshire Police were implicated in the problem, where they actually opened some gates which they shouldn't have opened, which allowed the crush to take place, which I think it's 96 people died in. And in this, on our programme last week, we had a bit of an exclusive with a guy called Tony Farrell. This is former senior intelligence analyst, who was talking about conversations that he had whilst he was in South Yorkshire Police about the assistant chief constable who was in charge of Hillsborough on that day simply crumbling, basically, right, as the disaster unfolded, rather than really managing the whole thing from the control room, where he had CCTV access to everything. And also, he was in radio contact with all the various police and other emergency services. Apparently, he crumbled completely. And that this was the monstrosity of the cover-up, was that the police lied about the fact. You know, there were other officers in the control room at the time about what had actually happened. So,
if that is true, how do you sleep at night with that? If that is true, how do you sleep at night with that on your conscience?
Well, this is one of the reasons, I think, that there's a serious problem with it all, because these police have quite clearly, it seems to me, and this was one of the implications that came out in the official inquiry too, had actually colluded to lie about what really happened on the day. So they basically fixed their stories to protect the assistant chief constable, who, by the way, carried on in his career and retired in 1995,
right,
6 years afterwards. So, really, he should, one would think, have been retired early, or certainly suspended, and he should not have been put in those sorts of positions of responsibility where, as it seems, on Hillsborough, he wasn't actually able to cope. So nobody's actually pointing the finger and blaming him 100% for what happened on the day. Mm. It was really the cover-up afterwards, which is so appalling. And I think it really smacks of a complete lack of proper oversight of the police. Now, another example of that is what we saw in the news, a couple of examples of this last week, where undercover police officers, the Guardian reported, have been going into infiltrate environmental campaigns, not terrorist groups, environmental campaigns, like cycling groups, and when those cycling groups are nicked for whatever reason, they have then also been keeping their cover as they go through the court process, that is to say, perjuring themselves in court about who they are, and this kind of thing is not even being properly investigated. These are the kind of investigative documentaries that we used to see. We're not seeing now.
Are people not getting the coverage? Is that why they're not? I mean, a lot of like Loose Change and so on, American documentaries, are very big and popular on the internet. Is that because people aren't getting the coverage? If they were to make a documentary, not getting TV channels that would buy it and use it. Is that the case?
Yeah, I mean, basically the mainstream television channels here in Britain are simply not showing these, any of these. They're not making these investigative documentaries, and they're not showing them because they're just work for whatever reason, they're too nervous. And in fact, I think, to be honest with you, the channel controllers don't actually find that very interesting. They find it all a little bit too bothersome. And what we've got is a spineless bunch of media managers. I mean, I think one of the things I always think is, you know, if the journalists themselves and the writers were actually able to, through some sort of co-op or whatever, manage and run their own affairs and to appoint the managers so the journalists were in charge, you'd find a whole different type of media. Because let's not forget that the journalists don't actually own the transmitters for the TV and the radio, and they don't actually own the printing presses. So you quite often find that the journalists would love to do a story, but then that story never actually finds its way into the newspaper or onto our TV screen.
It goes back to another documentary I saw, Outfoxed. I'm sure you've seen that, where they were saying when Murdoch took over at Fox, they were running their news stories, and suddenly they were told they had to play a speech by Ronald Reagan for about half an hour, which was over the news stories that they wanted to run. But they were told from a higher source that no, they were playing the Ronald Reagan stuff. So,
well, I don't know if the public realise, but our newsrooms have become battlegrounds, really, where really decent journalists have to kind of be very careful not to put their head above the parapet, because they very, very easily will not have their contracts renewed. I mean, this is another problem, of course, is things like short-term contracts. There's very little job security. And they find that, you know, someone who's been working for maybe 40 years as a journalist and built up loads of contacts knows pretty well the extent to which there is corruption in high places and is able to report on that where possible, is replaced by someone who's straight out of journalism school, and they only need to pay them half as much. I say even journalism school, some of the people they're employed are just literally have done a media studies degree, and they're maybe 20 years old, and suddenly they're in a situation where they're able to do broadcasting because they're much cheaper to employ. And also, they're less trouble. They're more in awe of the managers. They're more in awe of the whole news service, and they're easier to manipulate. Unfortunately, we are going down, I think, that old Soviet road where we get told what to think rather than we have a media that actually reflects the plurality of views out there in society.
Well, yeah, it's not going to get any better. And I think the most powerful people in the world are those that are running media. I'd just like to... you have some sort of, we talked about this because of my other job, that you have a faith as well, don't you, which governs what you believe.
Yeah, that's right, I'm a Freemason.
Right.
No, not really.
I was going to say, you shot me then, because we were talking about that earlier on. I'm getting back off the floor now, go on.
Yes, I'm not a Freemason, actually, no. Even though a lot of Freemasons believe you can be a Christian and a Freemason, they're wrong about that, because Christ himself makes it very clear. Never swear an oath, he says this in the Sermon on the Mount. Never swear an oath. Simply let your yes be yes and your no be no. And as we know, all Freemasons swear blood-curdling oaths when they join. In fact, the oath that they swear is basically them saying, you can kill me if I do anything which compromises Freemasonry, or I don't help another Freemason above all else. And that is the basic oath that they swear. Mm. So when Christ says, never swear an oath, you can look this up if you want in the Sermon on the Mount, and it says, anything else comes from the devil. So there's an interesting bit of advice for Christians who think that you can be a Christian and a Mason. I'm afraid you're wrong. If you listen to what Christ has to say, it's very clear about it. And their religion is what's called a deist religion, Freemasonry. And I think many people miss this aspect to it.
Yeah,
they think, well, this is a little club. It isn't. It's a religious cult. And their deism means that they talk about God all the time, but they don't actually really fix what they're talking about to the Bible. They really revere Solomon, who was quite an interesting character in the Old Testament, but he certainly wasn't a good guy. He started off fantastically well, Solomon, if you read the Old Testament. But then he went astray very, very, very badly, which is one of the reasons I'm rather suspicious about the way the Freemasons revere Solomon as such a fantastic chap. And their religion is, like I say, that. So they're talking about God all the time, but they're not actually pinning it down to the Bible, which means, essentially, that they can make anything that they want be what God says. And there are something like 300,000 Freemasons in Britain. Most join because they want privilege and promotion. They want some kind of advantage over the rest of us in society. And what they do find is that they are then suddenly in a religious cult. And I've seen film of people actually doing the Masonic initiation, the third degree. Now, you've heard that expression, oh, we're going to give you the third degree.
Yeah.
It's actually the third degree of Freemasonic initiation which gives rise to that term, because it's a particularly horrific rite they go through. And anybody that's going through that rite, you can see them literally trembling. I mean, I think what people are doing when they enter Freemasonry is cursing themselves, unfortunately, and it's actually not the easiest thing in the world to get out of. And some people, when they try to leave, they find their homes visited constantly by the Masons, and, you know, you're getting into a cult, so okay. Anybody that... Someone who's in Freemasonry, I think, you know, they should take whatever steps they can to help them to get out of it.
Okay, I want to know, is there, what is the link between Freemasonry and this group called the Bilderberg that you know about?
Oh, well, there are one or two very strong links, actually. The Duke of Kent is the head of World Freemasonry. And they're based, I mean, his kind of religion is based down in Covent Garden, a big Freemasons hall in London. And he, the last person to organise this Bilderberg conference, which quite a lot of people have found out about now, which is a secretive political arm of NATO. Where
the worst kept secret in the world, eh?
Well, it's
to some degree.
It's certainly an interesting conspiracy theory. It's an organisation which, for many years, even when I was putting stuff up on the internet and broadcasting about it, people would say it doesn't exist. Well, it does. It does exist. I've been along to two of those meetings, and it's got royalty. It's got the major banking people from Europe and North America, from the NATO countries, and it's got all the heads of the big oil companies. It's got a lot of big media people, including governors of the BBC or trustees, as they now are, of the BBC. And Rupert Murdoch's chief executive, for example, goes to these secret meetings. Henry Kissinger is a major player, who, of course, was responsible for the fascist coup in Chile in the 1970s. There is also David Rockefeller, who's a very senior sort of U.S. banker, who he started his business in oil and then realized that actually it's much easier to become a bank because you can just press a button and print, you know, millions or billions of dollars, and it's much less effort to make money as a bank than it is as an oil baron. And these meetings take place every year around about sort of May, June time. And Andrew Palmer organised the last one to take place in Britain, which is at Turnberry in Scotland in 1998. And it just so happens that he was the personal assistant to the Duke of Kent, the head of World Freemasonry. So you can see there's a pretty close connection there. The other one is that one of the founders, Joseph Rettinger, who was working for MI6 during the Second World War and shadowing around General Sikorsky, who's the Polish leader in exile, that Rettinger also was a Freemason. This has been looked into at the moment in Poland, and books being written about Rettinger's history as they realise that what a significant figure he was, in Polish, unfortunately, which I can't read. But so there are two figures, and then also there's Lord Carrington, who's the chairman of Bilderberg. So it looks like, you know, quite a lot of Masonic connections to this organisation, and that this is a sort of head of some kind of rather peculiar beast that's NATO.
Yeah.
The problem with all of this, though, of course, is who is in charge. I mean, we had, for example, George Osborne went along to the most recent Bilderberg meeting, but not in a private capacity, as the Bilderbergers will tell you. He actually went with his treasury team.
Wow.
So this is an official visit by George Osborne to this secret meeting.
So why are we not hearing about this on the mainstream media? Are they saying it's too boring? I mean, if you had a group of European leaders, which we have quite regular, or the G8 meeting, it's all over the news, but when this group meets, it's nowhere to be seen, are they?
Well, the reason is very simple. It's because a lot of the chief bosses of the mainstream media are there, and they don't want their organizations to report on it. I mean, for example, The Economist, which a lot of people look to as a sort of great sort of oracle as what's happening with the economy, and they have two reporters there at every Bilderberg conference, and they've never written a thing about it, hardly, and they only recently started to write the odd silly kind of, oh, isn't it silly the way conspiracy theorists write about this organisation, which is perfectly innocent, in the Economist magazine. I mean, the other thing with The Economist is a very weird magazine because there are no bylines. You won't find the names of journalists on any of the articles. Right. So if you want to question an article, you can't actually contact the journalist. If you want to correct an article, you can't contact the journalist. The whole thing is done almost as if it's from God, you know, so there's no individual journalist listed. I mean, as I said before, also the BBC, there's a BBC governor there. So that may be one of the reasons why they don't report it properly, but it certainly should be one of the most important.
How often do they meet, Tony?
They meet officially once a year as the conference, which is basically a schmooze fest, really, with all the kings and queens there. They invite anybody who's powerful, for example, an editor of a newspaper, that isn't necessarily 100% on board with their idea of what makes good economics. Yeah. So that's what they attempt to do with them.
Is it just Western? Sorry, is it
successful? Sometimes they're not.
Is it just Western governments that are involved and Western organisations, or is there Middle East?
Just the NATO countries. I mean, for example, it was interesting to see there was a guest from China for the first time ever at the last Bilderberg conference. But you see, they are really on the fringes. They're not in the driving seat. This is the steering committee runs Bilderberg, which is a small group, including people like Kenneth Clark, who's now the Justice Secretary. Yeah. He's for a long time. He was the head of British American Tobacco Corporation, and then he became Health Secretary. It's one of those weird little transitions, steps seamlessly out of running a massive tobacco company into being the Secretary of State for Health. There are other figures as well from Britain. Lord Mandelson, he's one of the people that regularly turns up there. But if people want to check out the Bilderbergs, the best place, I'm afraid, to do it is got to be on the internet, and that is at the Guardian website, where Charlie Skelton has done a very good sort of bunch of reports. He's a comedy writer, and he really does send them up beautifully. He also understands the gravity of it all, because these people really do control most of the money in the Western world, and they are responsible for this financial crisis we're now seeing. So I hope the next time that they meet, the whole lot of them will be arrested, and that the police force in whichever country they happen to meet next time will nab them all and question them, because this financial crisis is causing misery for millions of people right across Europe, and these are the people. If you look at the banks involved, these are the people responsible.
I wish I had your faith.
Well, you know, this is, you may say that, but when they met in Spain, apparently the police were actually saying to some of the people there who were doing this sort of demonstrating, they're waving placards and things, actually, maybe we should not be keeping an eye on you. We should be up there arresting them.
Yeah, so yeah, too right.
There was a certain amount of stomach amongst the Spanish police. I don't think they were Spanish. I think maybe they were from the Basque country or Andalusia or somewhere. That they were actually up for the idea of arresting the lot of them on the top of the hill, which would have been quite an interesting event. Yeah, I think ultimately, the people responsible for the financial crimes we're seeing, the banksters right now, are going to be arrested. It's just going to be a matter of time. They're doing everything they can to con us right now into thinking that they're trying to find a solution with silly little things like this pretend spat between Sarkozy and Cameron yesterday. But ultimately, I think that what they plan is, and I would go along a lot with what the French independent economic analysis website Leap 2020 says, and that is that what may well happen is that the Eurozone is somehow saved through funny money, and which would then mean that it's quite possible that the dollar and the pound and other currencies outside the Eurozone would be incredibly exposed, that the British banks and American banks and other non-Euro banks would be really exposed and may crash as a result of this deal that they're doing in Europe. Well, we'll see if they can actually do it.
Okay, Tony. We're going to have to leave it there, I'm afraid, because time is running out. But I'm definitely going to try and get you back on, maybe later on in the week even. Good to hear what you're saying, and loads of information for us to take on board. Tony Hawk.
You don't have to agree with it. Don't believe me about anything. Do go and check it out.
Yeah,
yourself.
And that's what really we're encouraging. And on this show as well, and I know on Talk Radio, we do this a lot, we invite people on, give them a platform and a forum, and it's for those listeners out there to go and investigate for themselves and find out. How can they find out more from your website, Tony?
Well, I think probably one of the best places to go is the radio station's website, which is thisweek.org.uk. You can download MP3s there back the last couple of years of different programs that we've done. I mean, we did one, for example, on BMW and the BMW's links to the Nazis. We did another show on Is the EU a Nazi Plot? Mm. I mean, this is one of the themes that comes up from time to time, but we do try and take a really good in-depth look at the whole financial situation, and warts and all.
Okay.
That's my motto.
Tony, thank you very much. It's good to speak to you, and no doubt we'll be speaking again soon.
Okay, and that website is thisweek.org.uk, but you'll find me elsewhere on the internet, on YouTube too.
Okay, lovely. Thank you, Tony. God bless, and take care of yourself. Speak to you soon. Bye-bye.
Viewpoint on Talk Radio Europe. Live comment and discussion with studio guests Nathan Thomas, Barry Nathan, and hosted by Steve Gilmore.
Now on Tuesdays, Viewpoint from 11 a.m. on Talk Radio Europe.